Sure, Dan said for Seems's benefit. They're probably safe. I know Earl's a good man, and I'm sure he won't let anything happen to them, but you better start running a tighter ship there. Or sooner or later, something'll happen to a client, and then there goes the whole agency's license. Lonnie started to say something more, but Dan hung up. He was desperate to get away from there, to find another phone and get back to Lonnie to hear more details. However, he didn't want to appear eager to depart because he didn't want Seems to come with him. And if Seems thought that Dan knew where Laura and Melanie were, there would be no hope of leaving alone and unobstructed. The FBI agent was staring hard at him. Dan said, "They don't know anything at Paladin."
"Is that what he told you?"
"Yeah.
What else did he tell you?"
He wanted and needed to trust Seems and the Bureau. He was, after all, a cop by choice, and he believed in authority, in systems of law and enforcement. Ordinarily, he would have given Seems his trust automatically, unthinkingly. But not this time. This was a twisty situation, with stakes so high that the usual rules didn't apply.
"He didn't tell me shit," Dan said.
"What do you mean?"
"Something's got you really scared all of a sudden."
"Not me."
"You just broke into a sweat."
Dan felt it on his face, cool and trickling. Thinking fast, he said, "It's this knock I took on the forehead. It feels okay, and I forget about it, and then all of a sudden the pain starts up again so bad it makes me weak."
"Hats?" Seems said.
"What?"
"At the sign of the Pentagon, you told me you'd hurt yourself while trying on hats."
"Did I? Well, I was just being a smartass."
"So, what really happened?"
"Well, see, usually I don't think very much or very hard, not used to it. Big dumb cop, you know. But today I had to think so hard that my head got hot, blistered the skin right off."
"I believe you're thinking hard all the time, Haldane. Every minute."
"You give me too much credit.
And I want to warn you to think hard about this. You're just a city cop, while I'm a federal agent."
"I am acutely aware of your exalted status and the hovering ghost of J. Edgar Hoover.
Though I can't meddle in your jurisdiction on just any excuse, I can find ways to make you wish you'd never crossed me."
"I never would, sir. I swear."
Seems just stared at him. Dan said, "Well, I guess I'll be going."
"Where?"
"Home, I guess," Dan lied. "It's been a long day. You're right, I've been working too much. And this head hurts like hell. Ought to take a few aspirins and make up an ice pack."
"All of a sudden you're no longer worried at all about the McCaffreys?"
"Oh, well, sure, I'm concerned about them," Dan said. "But there's nothing more I can do right now. I mean, this mess here, it's sort of on the suspicious side, but it doesn't necessarily indicate foul play, does it? I figure they're safe with Earl Benton. He's a good guy. Besides, Mr. Seems, a homicide cop has to have a pretty thick skin. Can't start identifying with the victims, you know. If we did that, we'd all be basket cases, right?"
Seems stared, unblinking.
Dan yawned. "Well, time to have a beer and hit the sack." He crossed at the door. He felt hopelessly obvious, transparent. He had no talent for deception. Seems spoke to him as he was about to step over the threshold.
"If the McCaffreys are in danger, Lieutenant, and if you really want to help them, you'd be wise to cooperate with me."
"Well, like I said, I don't suppose they are in danger right this minute," Dan said. Although he could still feel the sweat trickling down his face, and though his heart was racing, and though his stomach was again tied in a burning knot.
"Damn it, why are you being so stubborn? Why aren't you cooperating, Lieutenant?"
Dan met his eyes. "Remember when you pretty much accused me of selling out, turning the McCaffreys over to someone?"
"It's part of my job to be suspicious," Seems said.
"Mine too."
"You mean you suspect me of being opposed to that little girl's best interests?"
"Mr. Seems, I'm sorry, but though you have the round, unlined face of a cherub, that doesn't mean you're an angel at heart."
He left the house, went out to his car, and drove away. They didn't try to follow him,
probably because they realized it would be a wasted effort.
The first telephone that Dan saw was one of those artifacts whose steady disappearance seemed to symbolize the decline of modern civilization, a fully enclosed glass booth. It stood at the corner of a property occupied by an Arco service station. By the time that he saw the booth and parked beside it, he was shaking badly, not in a panic yet, but certainly within sight of one, which wasn't like him. Ordinarily, he was calm, collected. The worse that things got, the faster a situation deteriorated, the cooler he became. But not this time. Perhaps it was because he couldn't get Cindy Lakey out of his mind. Couldn't forget that tragic failure, or perhaps it was because the murders of his own brother and sister had been much on his mind in the past 24 hours. Or perhaps the attraction Laura McCaffrey had for him was even far greater than he was yet willing to admit. And perhaps the loss of her would be far more devastating than he could imagine. But whatever the cause of his crumbling self-control, he was becoming undeniably more frantic by the moment. Wexler's? Manuelo? Why was he suddenly so frightened of them? He had never liked either of them, of course. They were originally vice officers, and word was that they had been among the most corrupt in that division, which was probably why Ross Mondale had arranged for them to transfer under his command in the East Valley. He wanted his right-hand men to be the type who would do what they were told, who wouldn't question any questionable orders, whose allegiance to him would be unshakable as long as he provided for them. Dan knew that they were Mondale's flunkies, opportunists with little or no respect for their work or for concepts like duty and public trust. But they were still cops, lousy cops, lazy cops, but not hitmen like Ned Rink. Surely they posed no threat to Laura or Melanie. And yet, something was wrong. Just a hunch. He couldn't explain the intensity of his sudden dread, couldn't give concrete reasons for it, but over the years he had learned to trust his hunches, and now he was scared. In the booth he hastily and anxiously fumbled in his pockets for coins, found them. He punched the number for California Paladin into the keypad. His breath steamed the inner surface of the glass walls, while rain streamed down the exterior. The service station's silvery lights shimmered in the rippling film of water, and were diffused through the opalescent condensation. That curious lambent luminescence, combined with the unsettling harmonics of the storm, gave him the extraordinary sensation of being encapsulated and set adrift outside the flow of time and space. As he punched in the last digit of Paladin's number, he had the weird feeling that the booth door had closed permanently behind him, that he wouldn't be able to force his way out of it, that he would never see or hear or touch another human being again, but would forever remain adrift in that rectangular prison in the Twilight Zone, unable to warn or to help Laura and Melanie, unable to alert Earl to the danger, unable to save even himself. Sometimes he had nightmares of being utterly helpless, powerless, paralyzed, while right before his eyes a vaguely defined but monstrous creature tortured and murdered people whom he loved. However, this was the first time that such a nightmare had attempted to seize him while he was awake. He finished entering the number. After a few electronic beeps and clicks, a ringing came across the line. At first, even the ringing did not dispel the miasma of fear so thick it inhibited breathing. He half expected it to go on and on without response, for everyone knew that there were no telephone lines between reality and the Twilight Zone. But after the third ring, Lonnie Beamer said, "California Paladin." Dan almost gasped with relief. "Lonnie, it's Dan Haldane again. Have you regained your senses?" "Oh, that stuff I said, that was just for the benefit of a guy who was listening over my shoulder. After you hung up, I figured it out. Listen, as soon as I hang up this time, I want you to call Earl and tell him there's something fishy about all this police protection crap." "What are you talking about?" "Tell him the guys who come to his door might not really be cops, and he shouldn't open up to them."
You aren't making sense. Of course there'll be cops. Lonnie, something bad is about to go down. I don't know exactly what or why, but I know I talked to Ross Mondale. I mean, I recognized his voice, but I still called him back at his office number just to double-check who he was before I told him where Earl was keeping the McCaffreys.
All right, Dan said impatiently. Even if it's actually Wexler's and Manuelo who show up, tell Earl it stinks. Tell him I said he's in deep shit if he lets them in.
Listen, Dan, I can't tell him to shoot it out with a couple of cops. He doesn't have to shoot it out. Just tell him not to let them in. Tell him I'm on my way. He's got to hold out until I get there. Now, what the hell's the address of this safe house?
It's actually an apartment, Lonnie said. He gave Dan an address in Westwood, south of Wilshire.
Hey, you really think they're in danger? Call Earl, Dan said.
He slammed on the receiver, threw open the steam opaque door of the booth, and ran to the car. Chapter 28.
Under arrest, Earl repeated, blinking at Wexlersh, frowning at Manuelo. Earl looked every bit as surprised and baffled as Laura felt. She was on the sofa with Melanie, where the detectives had indicated that they wanted her to remain when they had first come into the room. She felt terribly vulnerable and wondered why she should feel vulnerable when they were only policemen who said they were there to help her. She had seen their identification, and Earl apparently had met them before, although he didn't seem to know them well, so there was every indication that they were what they claimed to be. Yet dark buds of doubt and fear began to flower, and she sensed that something was not right about this, not right at all. She didn't like the looks of these two cops, either. Manuelo had mean eyes, a superior smirk. He moved with a macho swagger, as if waiting for his authority to be questioned, so he could kick and stomp someone. Wexlersh, with his waxy white skin and flat gray eyes, gave her chills. She said, "What's going on? Mr. Benton is working for me. I hired his company." And then she had a crazy thought that she voiced at once. "My God, you didn't think he was holding us here against our will, did you?" Ignoring her, speaking to Earl Benton, Detective Manuelo said, "You carrying any iron?"
"Sure, but I have a permit," Earl said.
"Let me have it."
"The permit?"
"The piece."
"You want my weapon?"
"Now." Drawing his own revolver, Wexler said, "Be real careful when you hand it over."
Clearly astonished by Wexler's tone and suspicion, Earl said,
"You think I'm dangerous, for Christ's sake?"
"Just be careful," Wexler said coldly.
Handing his gun to Manuelo, Earl said,
"Why would I draw down on a cop?"
As Manuelo stuck the pistol in the waistband of his trousers, the telephone rang. Laura started to get up, and Manuelo said,
"Let it ring."
"But let it ring,"
Manuelo repeated sharply. The phone rang again. A dark stain of worry appeared on Earl's face and grew darker even as Laura watched. The phone rang, rang, and everyone seemed transfixed by the sound.
Earl said, "Hey, listen, there's been a serious mistake here." The phone rang.
Dan had clipped the detachable emergency beacon to the edge of the sedan's roof. Although the car was unmarked, there was a siren, too, and he used it and the flashing beacon to command the roadway ahead. Traffic pulled obediently out of his path. Considering the weather, he drove with too little regard for his own safety and for that of everyone else on the streets, plunging toward Westwood with uncharacteristic recklessness. If someone had corrupted Ross Mondale, and that possibility was far from unthinkable, and had arranged for him to betray Melanie, Mondale would have had no difficulty whatsoever persuading Wexlersh and Manuela to cooperate in the scheme. They could go to the safe house, gain admission with their police ID, and take the child. They would probably have to kill Laura and Earl to cover up the treachery, but the more Dan thought about it, the more certain he became that they wouldn't have any qualms about murder if they stood to gain enough from it. And they weren't taking much of a risk because they could always say that they'd found the bodies when they had arrived, and that the child had already been missing when they got there. He came to a place where the street passed beneath a freeway, and the depression in the pavement at the underpass was flooded, barring further progress. One car was stuck out in the middle of the whirling torrent, with water halfway up its doors, and several other vehicles were halted at the edge of the flood zone.
A truck from the city's Department of Streets had just arrived. Workers in reflective orange safety vests were setting up a pump and erecting barriers and starting to get traffic turned away and redirected. But for a minute or more, Dan was caught in the jam-up in spite of the flashing beacon on the roof of his sedan. As he sat there furious, cursing, blocked in by a car in front and a truck behind, rain drummed a monotonous rhythm on the roof and hood. The beat of each drop was like the tick of a precious second cast off by a clock, time raining away, valuable minutes streaming over him and pouring down the gutters. The phone rang 10 times, and each ring increased the tension in the room. Earl knew something was wrong, but he couldn't quite figure it out. He had met Wexlersch and Manuelo before, and he'd heard stories about them, so he knew that they weren't two of the sharpest men on the city's payroll. They could be expected to make mistakes, and this was surely a mistake. Lonnie Beamer had said they were coming to put Laura and Melanie under police protection. He'd said nothing about a warrant for Earl's arrest, and there couldn't be a warrant because Earl hadn't done anything illegal. From what Earl had heard of Wexlersch and Manuelo, it would be like them to screw up, to come charging in here misinformed, confused, operating under the gross misapprehension that they had not merely been sent to protect the McCaffreys, but to arrest him as well. But why wouldn't they answer the telephone? The call might be, probably was, for them. He couldn't figure it. The phone finally stopped ringing. Briefly, the silence seemed as absolute as that in a vacuum. Then Earl again became aware of the pounding of rain on the roof and in the courtyard. To his partner, Wexlersch said, "Cuff him." Earl said, "What the hell is this? You still haven't told me what I'm being arrested for." As Manuelo produced a pair of flexible and disposable plastic handcuffs from one of his jacket pockets, Wexlersch said, "We'll read the charges when we get you to the station house." They both seemed nervous, eager to get this over with. Why were they in such a hurry? Dan swung hard off Wilshire Boulevard onto Westwood Boulevard, heading south. He passed through a foot-deep puddle, and on both sides water plumed up as if vaguely phosphorescent wings had suddenly sprouted from the car. As he squinted through the rain-smeared windshield, the wet black pavement appeared to roll and squirm under the scintillant reflections of streetlights and neon signs. His eyes, already weary and burning, began to sting even worse. His battered head throbbed, but there was another pain as well, an inner pain that grew from unwanted thoughts of failure, from unwelcome and unavoidable premonitions of death and despair. Holding the plastic handcuffs, Manuelo came toward Earl and said, "Turn around and put your hands together behind your back." Earl hesitated. He looked at Laura and Melanie. He looked at Wexlersch, holding the Smith & Wesson police special. These guys were cops. But Earl suddenly was not sure that he should have done what they told him to, wasn't sure that he should have given up his gun, and he damn sure didn't like being handcuffed. "Are you going to resist arrest?" Manuelo demanded. Wexlersch said, "Yeah, Banton, for Christ's sake, you realize resisting arrest will be the end of your PI license?" Reluctantly, Earl turned and put his hands behind his back. "Aren't you going to read me my rights?" "Plenty of time for that in the car," Manuelo said as he slipped the plastic handcuffs around Earl's wrists and drew them tight. To Laura and Melanie, Wexler said, "Better get your coats." Earl said, "What about my coat? You should have let me put it on before you cuffed me." "You'll manage without a coat," Wexler said. "It's raining out there." "You won't melt," Manuelo said. The phone began to ring again. As before, the detectives ignored it. The siren failed. Dan tapped the control switch with his foot, clicked it on and off and on again, but the siren refused to come back to life. He was left with only the flashing red emergency beacon and his horn to get him through the rain-slowed traffic. He was going to be too late. Again. As was Cindy Lakey. Too late. Whipping and weaving from lane to lane, cutting dangerously in and out of traffic, blasting the horn, he was increasingly sure that they were dead. All dead. That he had lost a friend, and the innocent child he had hoped to protect, and the woman whose impact on him
admit it, had been somewhere in the 100 megaton range. All dead. Laura picked up Melanie's coat and dressed her first. It was a slower procedure than it might have been because the girl didn't help at all. Manuelo said, "What is she, a retard or something?" Astonished and angry, Laura said, "I can't believe you actually said that."
"Well, she don't act normal," Manuelo said.
"Oh, don't she?" Laura said scathingly. "Jesus, she's a very sick little girl. What's your excuse?"
While Laura got Melanie into the coat, Earl was directed to sit on the sofa. He perched on the edge. His arms were cuffed behind him. When Laura finished buttoning her daughter's raincoat, she picked up her own coat.
Wexler said, "Never mind that. You sit there on the sofa beside Benton."
"But sit!"
Wexler said, pointing at the sofa with his gun. His ice-gray eyes were unreadable. Or maybe Laura simply didn't want to read what was evident in them. She looked at Detective Manuelo. He was smirking. Turning to Earl for guidance, Laura saw that he looked more uneasy than ever.
"Sit,"
Wexler repeated, not stressing the word this time, almost speaking in a whisper, yet somehow conveying more authority and a greater potential for violence with that soft tone than he had when he'd spoken more harshly. Laura's stomach clenched and twisted. A sickening wave of dread swept through her. When Laura sat down, Wexler went to Melanie, took the girl by the hand, and led her away from the sofa, brought her to where he had been standing, and kept her between himself and Manuelo.
"No," Laura said miserably, but the two detectives ignored her.
Looking at Wexler, Manuelo said,
"Now?"
"Now,"
Wexler said. Manuelo reached under his coat and brought out a pistol. It wasn't the weapon that he had taken off Earl, and Laura didn't think that it was the detective's own service weapon either, because she was pretty sure policemen usually used revolvers. That was what Wexler was holding, a revolver. The moment she saw the new pistol in Manuelo's hand, she had a sharper sense that something was amiss. Then Manuelo took a burnished metal tube from his coat pocket and began to screw it onto the barrel of the pistol.
It was a silencer.
Earl said, "What the hell are you doing?"
Neither Wexler nor Manuelo answered him.
"Jesus Christ!" Earl said in shock and horror as a sudden and unacceptable realization dawned upon him. "No shouting," Wexler said. "No screaming."
Earl thrust off the sofa to his feet, uselessly struggling to free himself of the handcuffs. Wexler rushed at him, clubbed him with the revolver once on the shoulder, once alongside the face. Earl fell backward onto the sofa. Manuelo had gotten the threads of the silencer misaligned with those that had been machined into the barrel of the pistol, and he had to unscrew it and try again. Still looming over Earl, Wexler looked at his partner and said,
"Will you hurry up?"
"I'm trying, I'm trying,"
Manuelo said, wrestling with the stubborn attachment to the pistol.
"You crazy bastard's going to kill us,"
Earl said through split and bleeding lips. When Laura heard their fate put into blunt words, she wasn't surprised. She realized that she had known, if only subconsciously, what was coming, had sensed it when the detectives had first entered the room, had felt it even more strongly when they had handcuffed Earl, and had been convinced of it when Wexler had taken Melanie away from her, but hadn't wanted to accept the truth. Manuelo had misthreaded the silencer again.
"This thing's a piece of shit."
"It'll fit if you start it right,"
Wexler said. Laura understood that they didn't want to use their own revolvers for fear the murders would be traced to them, and they didn't want to fire the pistol without a silencer if they could avoid it, because the gunshots would bring neighbors to windows in other apartments, and then someone would see them leaving with Melanie. Melanie. She was standing near Manuelo, whimpering. Her eyes were closed, her head bowed, and she was making small, lost, pathetic sounds. Did she know what was about to happen in this room? That her mother was about to die, or was she whimpering about something else? Something in her private inner fantasy world. In a tone that was part disbelief, but mostly rage, Earl said,
"You're cops, for God's sake!"
Wexler said, "You just sit there and be quiet."
Laura's gaze had settled on a heavy glass ashtray on the coffee table. If she grabbed it,
threw it at Wexler's and managed to hit him in the head, it might knock him unconscious or cause him to drop his gun, and if he dropped his gun, she might be able to reach it before either he or Manuelo could react. But she needed a diversion. She was desperately trying to think of something to distract Wexler's when Earl evidently decided they had nothing to lose by resisting. He distracted both detectives at exactly the right moment. As Manuelo continued to struggle with the poorly fitted silencer, Earl looked at Wexler and said, "No matter what we do, no matter how loud we scream, you're not going to use your own gun or mine." Then, shouting for help at the top of his voice, Earl launched himself up toward Wexler, using his head as a ram. Wexler stumbled back 2 steps as Earl butted him in the stomach, but the detective didn't fall. In fact, he struck down with the gun, clubbing the bodyguard to the floor, putting an abrupt end to the attack and to the shouting. In the brief confusion, Laura snatched up the ashtray even as Wexler struck Earl. Manolo saw her and said, "Hey!" just as she heaved the object at Wexler, which was sufficient warning for the detective, who ducked and let the ashtray sail past him. It thudded into the wall, thumped to the floor. Wexler pointed his service revolver straight at Laura, and within the muzzle was the deepest blackness that she had ever seen. "Listen, you bitch, if you don't sit down right now and keep your trap shut, we'll make this a lot harder on you than it has to be." Melanie was mewling softly now, in increasing distress. Her head was still bowed, her eyes closed, but her mouth was open and slack as the pitiful sounds issued from her. Flopping onto his back, pulling himself up against the sofa, streaming blood from a scalp wound, Earl glared at Wexler. "Yeah, is that so? Make it harder on us, huh? What the hell could be worse than what you're already planning to do?" Wexler smiled. It was a singularly unsettling expression on his bloodless lips and moon-pale face. "We could tape your mouth shut and torture you for a while, then torture this bitch here." Shuddering, Laura looked away from his gray eyes. The room seemed cold, colder than it had been. "She's a nice piece of ass," Manuelo observed. "Yeah, we could screw her," Wexler said. "Screw the kid, too," Manuelo said. "Yeah," Wexler said, still smiling. "That's right. We could screw the kid. Even though she is a retard," Manuelo said, then cursed the pistol and silencer that wouldn't fit together properly. Wexler said, "So if you don't just sit there quiet-like, we'll tape your mouths shut and screw the kid right in front of you, and then kill you anyway." Gagging, choking down the vomit that rose into her throat, Laura settled back on the sofa, subdued by this crudest of all threats. Earl had been silenced, too. "Good," Wexler said, massaging his stomach with one hand where Earl had butted him. "Much better." Melanie's mewling had grown louder and was punctuated with a few words. "Open. Door. Open. No." And with deep, quaverous gasps. "Shut up, kid," Wexler said, lightly slapping her face. Her whimpering subsided, but she wasn't silenced altogether. Laura wanted to go to the girl, hug her, hold her close, but for her own sake and Melanie's, she had to stay where she was. The room was definitely cold and getting colder. Laura remembered how the kitchen had grown frigid just before the radio had come to life. And again just before the wind thing had thrown open the door and surged in from the darkness. Wexler said, "Don't they have heat in this damn place?" "There," Manuelo said, finally screwing the silencer onto the barrel of the gun. Colder. Holstering his own revolver now that his partner was at last ready to do the deed, grabbing Melanie by one arm and pulling her out of the way, Wexler edged backward toward the front door of the apartment. Colder. Laura was electrified, charged with tension and anticipation. Something was about to happen. Something strange. Manuelo stepped closer to Earl, who regarded him with more contempt than terror. The temperature of the room plunged precipitously now, and behind Wexler and Melanie, the apartment door flew open with a crash. But nothing supernatural burst into the room. It was Dan Haldane. He came through the door fast, even as he opened it. He took in the situation with remarkable alacrity and jammed his revolver into Wexler's back as that detective was starting to swing toward the door. Manuelo spun around, but Haldane said, "Drop it! Drop it, you bastard, or I'll blow you away!"
Manuelo hesitated, probably not because he was worried about his partner getting killed, but because it was clear that Wexler's body would stop the first bullet meant for Dan, and because it was equally clear that Manuelo wouldn't have a chance to fire twice before Dan took his head off. He glanced at Melanie, too, as though calculating the chances of leaping toward her, grabbing her, but when Dan shouted at him again, "Drop it!" Manuelo finally conceded the game and let the silencer-equipped pistol fall to the floor. "He's got Earl's gun," Laura warned Dan. "And his own service revolver, too," Earl added. Keeping a grip on Wexler's coat, the revolver still jammed hard in the man's back, Dan said, "Okay, Manuelo, get rid of the other two pieces, slow and easy, no funny stuff." One at a time, Manuelo rid himself of the weapons, then backed across the room and stood against the wall as Dan directed. Laura came forth to gather up the three firearms while Dan relieved Wexler of his service revolver. "Why the hell is it so cold in here?" Dan asked. But even as he voiced the question, the air grew warm again as swiftly as it had turned frigid. Something almost happened, Laura thought. Something like what happened in the kitchen at our house earlier. But she didn't think that they had been about to get just another warning. Not this time, no. This would have been worse. She had the unsettling feeling that it had been within seconds of making an appearance. Dan was looking at her strangely, as if he knew that she had an answer for him. But she couldn't speak. She didn't know how to put it into words that would make any sense at all to him. She knew only that if it had come, the slaughter here would have been far worse than any that the two corrupt detectives had been planning. If it had come, would they all have wound up like the battered, torn and mangled bodies in the house in Studio City? Chapter 29. In the emergency room at UCLA Medical Center, Earl was admitted for immediate treatment of his scalp wound and split lips. Laura and Melanie waited in the lounge adjacent to the emergency admitting desk while Dan went to the nearest payphone. He called the East Valley Division number and got Ross Mondale's extension. "Working late, aren't you, Ross?"
"Haldane?
Didn't know you were so industrious.
What do you want, Haldane?"
"World peace would be nice. I'm not in the mood for, but I guess I'd settle for a solution to this case."
"Listen, Haldane, I'm busy here, and you're going to be even busier, because you're going to have to spend a lot of time thinking up alibis."
"What are you talking about? Wexler and Manuelo?" Mondale was silent. Dan said, "Why'd you send them down to Westwood, Ross?"
"I guess you didn't know, but I've decided to provide police protection for the McCaffreys."
"Even with the current manpower shortage?"
"Well, considering the Scaldone killing tonight and the extreme violence of these crimes, it seemed prudent to stuff a sock in it, you son of a bitch."
"What?"
"I know they were going to kill Earl and Laura."
"What are you talking about?"
"And snatch Melanie. Have you been drinking, Haldane? And then go back later and report that Earl and Laura were already dead when they got there."
"Am I supposed to be making sense out of this?"
"Your confusion almost sounds genuine."
"These are serious accusations, Haldane."
"Oh, you're so smooth, Ross."
"These are fellow officers we're talking about here. Who'd you sell out to, Ross?"
"Haldane,
I advise you. And what did you get for selling out? That's the big question. Listen, hold on a sec. Bear with me. Let me theorize a bit, okay? You wouldn't have sold out just for money. You wouldn't put your entire career on the line just for money, not unless it was a couple of million, and nobody would have paid that kind of dough for a job like this. 25,000 tops, probably 15. That's more like it. Now, I can believe Wexler and Manuela would have done it for that kind of money. Maybe even less. But neither of them would have whacked Earl and Laura without your approval. Without a guarantee of your protection. So I'd say they got the money and you got something else. Now, what could that something else be, Ross? You'd sell out for power. For a really important promotion, maybe. For a guarantee of the chief's post and maybe even a mayoral nomination. So, whoever bought you is somebody who controls political machinery. Am I getting warm, Ross? Did you trade Laura and Melanie McCaffrey for those kinds of promises? Mondale was silent. Did you, Ross?
This sounds worse than drunk, Dan. This is spacey. Are you on drugs or what?
Did you, Ross?
Where are you, Dan?
Dan ignored the question. He said, Manuelo and Wexler are at that apartment in Westwood right now, gagged and hog-tied, one on the commode and the other in the bathtub. I'd have flushed them both down the drain if they'd have fit. You are high on something, by God. Give it a rest, Ross. Paladin is sending a couple of men over there to babysit your boys. And I've already called a reporter at the Times and another one at the Journal. Called the division over there, too. Told them who I was. Told them there'd been an attempted murder, so they've got uniforms on their way. It's going to be a circus. After another silence, Mondale said, Is Mrs. McCaffrey going to give a statement accusing Wexler and Manuelo of attempted murder?
Beginning to worry, Ross?
They're my officers, Mondale said. My responsibility. If they've actually done what you say, then I want to be absolutely sure they're eventually indicted and convicted. I don't want any damned rotten apples in my barrel. I don't believe in covering up for my men out of some misguided sense of police brotherhood.
What's the matter, Ross? Do you think I'm recording this call?
You think someone's listening in? Well, there's no one listening. No tape. So you can drop the act. I don't understand your attitude, Dan.
Nobody does.
I don't know why you suspect me of being involved.
He was a lousy actor. His insincerity was as obvious as a lisp or a stutter.
And you haven't answered my question. Is Mrs. McCaffrey going to give a statement accusing Wexler and Manuelo of attempted murder, or isn't she?
Dan said, Not tonight. I've taken Laura and Melanie away from there, and I'm keeping them with me, well hidden for the duration. I know you're disappointed to hear that. They'd have sure made easy targets for a sniper if they'd hung around, wouldn't they? But I'm not telling anyone where they are. I'm not letting them meet with any cops from any division, either to give a statement or to identify Wexler and Manuelo in a lineup. I don't trust anyone anymore.
You're not talking like a responsible cop, Dan.
I'm such an imp.
For God's sake, you can't take personal responsibility for the McCaffreys.
Just watch me.
If they need protection, you've got to arrange it through the department. Which is what I thought I was doing when I sent Wexler and Manuelo over there. You can't handle this by yourself. Good heavens, these people aren't your own family, you know? You can't just take charge of them as if it's your legal right or something.
If they want me to, I can. They aren't my family, you're right. But just the same, I've got something at stake here.
What are you talking about?
You said it yourself at the sign of the pentagram tonight. This isn't an ordinary case for me. That's why I'm holding on so tight. I'm attracted to Laura, and I pity the girl. What I feel for them is stronger than anything I've ever felt for other victims, so you keep that in mind, Ross.
Right there's reason enough to disassociate yourself from this case. You're no longer an objective officer of the law.
Fuck you.
This explains why you're so hostile, hysterical, filled with all these paranoid conspiracy theories.
It's not paranoia. It's real, and you know it.
I understand now. You're distraught.
I'm just warning you, Ross. Back off. That's why I even bothered calling you. Those two words, back off.
Mondale said nothing, so Dan said, This woman and this child are important to me.
Mondale breathed softly into the phone, but made no promises. Dan said, I swear to God, I'll destroy anyone who tries to hurt them. Anyone.
Silence.
Dan said, You may be able to keep Wexler and Manuelo quiet. You might even find a way to have the charges dropped and the whole thing covered up. But if you keep coming after the McCaffreys, I'll find a way to break your ass. I swear it, Ross.
At last, Mondale spoke, but not to the point, as if he had heard none of Dan's warning. Well, if you won't let Mrs. McCaffrey make a statement, then Wexler and Manuelo can't be arrested.
Oh, yes. Earl Benton can make a statement. He was pistol-whipped by Wexler. Earl's at a hospital getting patched up.
Which hospital?
Get serious, Ross.
Finally, out of frustration, Mondale showed a little of what he was really feeling. The dam didn't break, but a hairline crack appeared in it. You bastard. I'm sick of you. Sick of you and your threats. Sick to death of having you hanging over me like a goddamn sword.
That's good. Get it out, Ross. Get it off your chest.
Mondale was silent again. Dan said. Anyway, if Earl's released from the hospital, he's going back to the department and talk with the uniforms who answered my call. Give them a statement. See to it that Wexler and Manuelo are booked on charges of assault and battery, plus assault with intent to kill. Mondale had control of himself now. He wouldn't lose it again. Dan said, and if the doctors want to hold him overnight for observation, then police from this division will be coming here for his statement. Either way, Wexler and Manuelo aren't going to skip out on this one. Unless you work your buns off to slip them free of the hook, which I figure you'll have to do in order to keep them quiet. No response. Just heavy breathing. When and if you finally smooth it over, Ross, you might be able to convince Chief Kelsey that you and Wexler and Manuelo weren't involved in a plot to snatch the girl and kill her mother. But the press will still figure something was going on. And they'll never quite trust you again. Reporters will always be sniffing around you for the rest of your career, waiting for you to put a foot wrong. Silence. You hear what I'm saying, Ross? Silence. At best, you'll hold on to your captain's bars. But you won't be on the mayor's short list for chief, not anymore. Now, see, this is a warning, Ross. This is why I called you. Listen close. Listen good. If you keep coming after the McCaffreys, you'll be completely ruined. I'll see to it. I'll personally guarantee it. You're half ruined now, but if you keep coming after them, you won't even remain a captain. I'll bring you down all the way. No matter who put you up to this, no matter how powerful and influential he is, he won't be able to save your ass if you try to touch the McCaffreys again. He won't be able to save you from me. You get the picture? Silence. But it was a silence with an emotional quality now, and the emotion it radiated was hatred. Dan said, I still have to worry about the FBI. And I have to worry about whoever was financing Dylan McCaffrey and Willie Huffritz, because somebody out there wants that little girl real bad. But I'll be damned if I'm going to keep worrying about you, Ross. Tonight, you're going to relinquish your place on the Special Task Force and hand the whole case over to someone else until you've cleared up this cloud of suspicion hanging over Wexler and Manuelo. Understand? I'm not suggesting this, Ross. I'm telling you. You shithead. Sticks and stones. Listen good. If you don't say what I want to hear, Ross, I'm going to hang up, and when I hang up, it's too late for you to change your mind. Silence. Well, goodbye, Ross. Wait. Sorry, gotta go. All right, I agree. What? What you said. Make it plainer. I'll take myself off the case. Very wise. I'll even take a week of sick leave. Oh, not feeling well? Mondale said, I'll get out of this, walk away from it, but I want something from you. What? I don't want Benton or you or the McCaffreys giving any statements about Wexler and Manuelo. Fat chance. I mean it. Nonsense. The only way we have a hold on you is if we get those two creeps booked for attempted murder. Okay. Let Benton give his statement. But in a couple days, when you feel the McCaffreys are safe, then Benton retracts his accusations. He'd look like a fool. No, he can say someone else beat him up, and that he took a bad knock on the head. He was confused, and he mistakenly accused Wexler and Manuelo. In a couple days, he can say his head cleared, and then he remembered what really happened. He can say it was some other bum who beat on him, and that Wexler and Manuelo actually saved his ass. You're in no position to demand anything from me, Ross. God damn it, if you don't give me an out, a glimpse of light, then I don't have any reason for playing along with you. Maybe. But if we're bargaining, then I want something else, too. I want the name of the man who got to you, Ross. Now, who wants the girl, Ross? Tell me, and we've got a deal. Now, who convinced you to use Wexler and Manuelo this way? Impossible. I tell you, and I'm really finished. I'm dog meat. I'd rather go down now, fighting, than rat on anybody, and maybe wind up like those bodies in Studio City, or worse. I give you the McCaffreys, and after a few days, you give me Wexler and Manuelo. That's the deal. You've got to at least tell me if he's the one who financed the work in that gray room.
I think so.
Is he government?
Maybe.
You have to do better.
I just don't know. He's the kind of guy who could be a conduit for the government, or maybe he financed it himself.
Rich?
I'm not giving you his name. And I'm not giving you so many details you could guess his name. Hell, I'd be signing my own death warrant.
Dan thought a moment then. He say anything about what they were trying to prove in that gray room?
No.
This guy, this one who got to you, this one who financed that crazy research, is he doing the killing, Ross?
Silence.
Is he, Ross? Come on. Don't be afraid to talk. You've already said too much. I'm not insisting on his name, but I've got to have an answer to this one. Is he responsible for Scaldone and those bodies in Studio City?
No, just the opposite. He's scared that he's going to be the next target.
Well, who's he afraid of?
I don't think it's a who.
What?
This is crazy, but the way these people talk, they're so scared you'd think it was Dracula who was after them. I mean, from things I've heard, I somehow get the idea it's not a person they're afraid of. It's a thing. Some thing is killing everyone connected with the Grey Room. I know that sounds like horseshit, but it's the feeling I get. Now, damn it, do we have a deal or not? I back out of this, give you the McCaffreys, and you give me Wexler's and Manuelo. Is that agreeable?
Dan pretended to think about it, then.
Okay. We got a deal?
Yeah. Mondale laughed nervously. His laughter had a filthy edge to it as well.
You realize what this means, Haldane?
What's it mean?
You make a deal like this, you drop charges against men you believe to have intended murder. Well, then you're just as dirty as anybody.
Not as dirty as you. I could float in a sewer for a month and eat whatever drifted by, and I still wouldn't be half as dirty as you, Ross. He hung up. He had eliminated one threat. No one would be using police badges to get close to Melanie. They still had an army of enemies, but now there was one less variety of them. And the beauty of it was that he had not given up anything in return for Ross Mondale's retreat, had not even slightly dirtied his hands because he didn't intend to uphold his end of the bargain. He would never ask Earl to withdraw his accusations against Wexler and Manuelo. In fact, when the case was finally broken and it was safe for Laura and Melanie to appear in public, Dan would encourage them to testify as well against the two detectives, and he would add his own testimony to the record. Manuelo and Wexler were finished. And by extension, so was Ross Mondale. Chapter 30. At 5:25, the hospital released Earl Benton. Laura was shocked by the bodyguard's battered appearance, even after the blood had been cleaned off his face. On the side of his head, doctors had shaved a spot half as large as the palm of a hand and had closed the wound with 7 sutures. Now it was covered with a bandage. His lips were purple and swollen, his mouth was distorted. One eye was black. He looked as if he'd had a close encounter with a truck. His appearance affected Melanie. The girl's eyes cleared. She seemed to swim up from her trance to peer more closely at him, as if she were a fish rising to the surface of a lake to examine a curious creature standing on the shore.
"Ah," she said sadly. She seemed to want to say something more to Earl, so he leaned toward her. She touched his battered face with one hand, and her gaze moved slowly from his bruised chin to his split lips, to his black eye, to the bandage on his head. As she studied him, she chewed worriedly on her lower lip. Her eyes filled with tears. She tried to speak, but no sound came from her.
"What is it, Melanie?" Earl asked. Laura stooped beside her daughter and put one arm around her.
"What are you trying to tell him, honey? Think one word at a time. Take it nice and slow. You can get it out. You can do it, baby."
Dan, the doctor who had treated Earl, and a young Latino nurse were watching attentively, expectantly. The child's tear-blurred gaze continued to move over Earl's face from one battle scar to another, and at last she said,
"For me."
"Yes," Laura said. "That's right, baby. Earl was fighting for you. He risked his life for you."
"For me,"
Melanie repeated with awe, as if being loved and protected was an entirely new and amazing concept to her.
excited by this crack in Melanie's autistic armor, hoping to widen it or even shatter the armor completely, Laura said, "We're all fighting for you, baby. We want to help. We will help you if you'll let us."
"For me,"
Melanie said again, but she would say no more. Although Laura and Earl continued to coax her, Melanie did not speak again. Her tears dried, and she lowered her hand from Earl's injured face, and that faraway look returned to her eyes. She bowed her head, weary. Laura was disappointed, but not despairing. At least the child seemed to want to come back from her dark and private place. And if she had a strong desire to recover, she would probably do so, sooner or later. The emergency room physician suggested that Earl stay overnight for observation, but in spite of the drubbing that he had taken, Earl resisted. He wanted to return to the safe house and make a statement to the police, thereby pounding a few nails into a tandem coffin for Wexler's and Manuelo. They had all come to the hospital in Dan's car, but now Dan didn't want to go back to the safe house. He didn't want Laura and Melanie to be near any other cops, so they called a taxi for Earl.
"Don't wait with me," Earl said. "You guys get out of here."
"We might as well wait," Dan said, "because we've got a few things to talk over anyway." Without discussing it, they grouped around Melanie, shielding her. They stood just inside the front entrance of the medical center, where they could see the rain-lashed night and the place where the taxi would pull up. Half the fluorescent lights in the lobby were switched off, for it was well after visiting hours, and the other half cast fuzzy bars of cold, unpleasant light across the large room. The air smelled vaguely of rose-scented disinfectant. Except for the four of them, the place was deserted.
"You want Paladin to send someone out here to take over for me?" Earl asked.
"No," Dan said.
"Didn't think you would."
"Paladin's damned good," Dan said, "and I've never had reason to doubt their integrity. And I still don't have reason.
But in this particular case, you don't trust anyone at Paladin any more than you trust anyone on the police force," Earl said.
"Except you," Laura said. "We know we can trust you, Earl. Without you, Melanie and I would be dead."
"Don't credit me with anything heroic," Earl said. "I was plain stupid. I opened the door to Manuelo."
"But you had no way of knowing."
"But I opened the door," Earl said.
And the expression of self-disgust on his face was unmistakable, in spite of the way his injuries distorted his features. Laura could see why Dan and Earl were friends. They shared a devotion to their work, a strong sense of duty, and a tendency to be excessively self-critical. Those were qualities seldom found in a world that seemed daily to put more stock in cynicism, selfishness, and self-indulgence. To Earl, Dan said, "I'll find a motel, get a room, and hole up there with Laura and Melanie the rest of the night. I thought of taking them back to my place, but someone might be expecting me to do just that."
"And tomorrow?" Earl asked.
"There are several people I want to see. Can I help?"
"If you feel up to it when you get out of bed in the morning."
"I'll feel up to it," Earl assured him. Dan said, "There's a woman named Mary Catherine O'Hara in Burbank. She's secretary of an organization called Freedom Now." He gave Earl the address and outlined the information he wanted from O'Hara. "I also need to find out about a company called John Wilkes Enterprises. Who are its officers, majority stockholders?"
"Is it a California corporation?" Earl asked.
"Most likely," Dan said. "I need to know when the incorporation papers were filed, by whom, what business they're supposed to be in."
"How's this John Wilkes outfit come into it?"
Earl asked, which was something Laura wondered about, too. "It'll take a while to explain," Dan said. "I'll tell you about it tomorrow. Let's get together for a late lunch, say 1 o'clock, and try to make something out of the information we've gathered."
"Yeah, I should have dug up what you want by then," Earl said.
He suggested a coffee shop in Van Nuys because he said it was a place in which he had never seen anyone from Paladin.
"It's not a cop hangout either," Dan said.
"Sounds good."
"Here's your cab,"
Laura said, as headlights swept across the glass doors and briefly sparkled in the raindrops that quivered on those panes. Earl looked down at Melanie and said,
"Well, princess, can you give me a smile before I go?"
The girl peered up at him, but Laura saw that her eyes were still strange, distant.
"I'm warning you," Earl said. "I'm going to hang around and bother you until you finally give me a smile."
Melanie just stared. To Laura, Earl said, "Keep your chin up, okay? It's going to work out." Laura nodded.
"And thanks for—"
"For nothing," Earl said. "I opened the door for them. I've got to make up for that. Wait until I make up for that before you start thanking me for anything." He stepped to the lobby doors, started to push one open, then glanced back at Dan and said, "By the way, what the hell happened to you?"
"What?"
Dan asked.
"Your forehead."
"Oh." Dan glanced at Laura, and she could tell by his expression that he'd come by his injury while working on the case. And she could also tell that he didn't want to say as much and make her feel at all responsible. He said, "There was this little old lady. She hit me with her cane."
"Oh?"
Earl said. "I helped her cross the street."
"Then why would she hit you?"
"She didn't want to cross the street," Dan said. Earl grinned. It was a macabre expression on his battered face, pushed the door open, ran through the rain, and disappeared into the waiting taxi. Laura zipped up Melanie's jacket. She and Dan kept the girl between them as they hurried out to his unmarked department sedan. The air was chilly. The rain was cold. The darkness seemed to breathe with malevolent life. Out there, somewhere, it waited. The motel room had two queen-size beds with purple and green spreads that clashed with the garish orange and blue drapes that in turn clashed with the loud yellow and brown wallpaper. There was a certain kind of eye-searing decor to be found in about one-fourth of the hotels and motels in every state of the Union, from Alaska to Florida, an unmistakable, bizarre decor of such a particular nature that it seemed to Dan that the same grossly incompetent interior decorator must be traveling frantically from one end of the country to the other, papering walls and upholstering furniture and draping windows with factory-rejected patterns and materials. The beds had mattresses that were too soft, and the furniture was scarred, but at least the place was clean. On the credit side of the ledger, the management provided a percolator and complimentary foil packets of Hills Brothers and Mocha Mix. Dan made coffee while Laura put Melanie to bed. Although the girl had seemed to drift through the day with all the awareness of a sleepwalker, expending little energy, it was late, and she fell asleep even as her mother was tucking the covers around her. A small table and two chairs stood by the room's only window, and Dan brought the coffee to it. He and Laura sat, mostly in shadow, with one small lamp burning just inside the door. The drapes were partly open to reveal a section of the rain-swept parking lot where ghostly, bluish light from mercury vapor lamps made strange patterns on the glass and chrome of the cars and shimmered eerily on the wet macadam. While Dan listened with growing amazement and disquiet, Laura told him the rest of the story that she had begun in the car. The levitating radio that seemed to broadcast a warning, the whirlwind filled with flowers that had burst through the kitchen door. She clearly found it difficult to credit these apparently supernatural events, though she had witnessed them with her own eyes. "What do you make of it?" he asked when she had finished.
"I was hoping you could explain it to me."
He told her about Joseph Scaldone being killed in a room where all the windows and doors had been locked from inside. "Considering that impossibility on top of what you've told me happened at your place, I guess we've got to accept that there's something here, some power, some force that's beyond human experience. But what the hell is it?"
"Well, I've been thinking about it all evening, and it seems to me that whatever possessed that radio and carried those flowers into the kitchen is not the same thing that's killing people. In retrospect, scary as it was, the presence in my kitchen wasn't fundamentally threatening. And like I said, it seemed to be warning us that what killed Dylan and Huffritz and the others is eventually going to come for Melanie, too."
"So we've got both good spirits and bad spirits," Dan said.
"I guess you could think of them that way."
"Good ghosts and bad ghosts."
"I don't believe in ghosts," she said.
"Neither do I. But somehow, in their experiments in that room, your husband and Huffritz seem to have tapped into and then unleashed occult entities, some of which are murderous, and some of which are at least benign enough to issue warnings about the bad ones. And until I can think of something better, well, ghosts seems to be the best word for them. They fell silent. They sipped the last of their coffee. The rain came down hard, harder. It roared. At the far end of the room, Melanie murmured in her sleep and shifted under the covers, then grew still and quiet again. At last, Laura said, "Ghosts. It's just crazy. Madness. Insanity." He switched on the dim light over the table.